Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
So we're going to start today's episode of Fresnolandia with some quick headlines and updates in the local news. And we'll start with what we covered last week, which was Fresno's District 5 special election. Do we still not have a winner?
We still don't have a winner, although Brandon Fang is still the front runner. We will have a winner announced this Friday, April 4th. It will end. We've counted a few more votes. Just, I think, 37 votes got counted in the last week. And
that's Brandon, not a lot of votes.
It's not.
It change the margins at all?
The margins changed ever so slightly. So just to recap for everyone, in this race, in order for someone to be a winner outright, they have to have 50% of the vote plus one. Brandon Vang is hanging on at 50.16% of the vote. So after the next count of ballots, if he drops below that, below 50%, then we'll go to a runoff in which he would then face off against Elizabeth Jonathan Rosas. We will know Friday whether that happens.
Do we know how many votes are coming Friday or another small batch like that, something a similar size?
There's about 130 ballots left.
Okay. So that could change the direction of the election.
It could. And there's this process happening right now called signature curing.
Okay.
And that's the process where, you know, so when you mail in a ballot or when you vote, you have to sign your name. And they have a process where they verify that your signature on the ballot matches your signature on file with the county. So that when those signatures don't match, they'll toss out the ballot and you have time to basically fight that and protest, and that's called the curing process. So we have until the 2nd of April to finalize that. So that's what they're waiting on right now.
Got it. And have both campaigns been pretty quiet, just waiting for the results?
Yeah, everyone's been quiet, not saying a lot. No one's doing victory laps just yet.
Gotcha. So we'll know Friday. The other big thing that we wanted to talk about is we had a really in-depth episode looking at this burgeoning environmental situation on the San Joaquin River with a multinational cement company proposing to blast a 600-foot hole in the middle of the ravine there in the canyon. And we've had some local elected officials come out in opposition to this.
Yeah. So first we have Assemblymember Dr. Joaquin Arambula, who introduced a bill in the state legislature that would basically specifically ban mining of this kind on rivers where the groundwater levels are lower than 50 feet, which is exactly the conditions that are present on the San Joaquin River where CEMEX wants to blast the mine. So it's pretty ostensibly targeted toward this proposal. And then interestingly enough, Mayor Jerry Dyer of Fresno came out and said that he supported efforts to block the mining proposal and is not behind what CEMEX is trying to do. And his rationale is really focused on the effects to traffic that this would have, lots of trucks traveling up and down Fryant Road. Everyone who drives Fryant knows it's a very impacted road, and so that was the main reason that he specified.
Interesting. So you have an environmental concern and then a NIMBY concern aligning against this kind of project.
Yeah, which is, if you think about it, where CEMEX is basically across the street from Copper River.
Yeah.
Copper River is a very...
If they're concerned about traffic, we all have to be, right?
Yes. Copper River concerns are going to hold some sway.
Okay. When is that going before the county supervisors?
So it takes a few months to get through the process. So where we're at right now is the public comment period for the environmental impact report is done. I've heard there's been nearly 1,000 comments submitted to the county. Now the county is in the process of reading through all those comments, answering them, and we'll hear probably later this summer when there's going to be some public hearings to talk more about it. On today's episode, we are joined by Genoveva Islas, who is the founder and director of local health nonprofit Cultiva la Salud. She's also a Fresno Unified trustee, to talk about the impacts of the Trump administration's cuts through Health and Human Services on a new model that has been forming in Fresno County over the last few years that's really focused on improving rural health outcomes. And that program has seen some major cuts. Just last week, Fresno County saw $11 million of cuts to the community health worker programs through a few different grants. It's affected over nearly a dozen local nonprofits in Fresno County, and Veva runs one of those nonprofits. Thanks for joining us today, Veva.
Thanks, Danny. I wish it was for a better story, but glad to be here with you.
Yeah, and this is something that you've been working on for a really long time. And so I'm hoping you could just start with, before we get into the cuts, tell us more about the community health worker model. Where did this type of work begin?
I feel like there's a faction of purists that would say that this is actually a model based on promotoras that are from Mexico and Latin America. We see promotora models in places like Cuba that were really extensions of the healthcare system. Like going to knock on a door to say, hey, you missed your mammogram. What happened? Can we help you rebook your appointment? Do you need transportation to get there? And so those type of models eventually found their way into the U.S. and they've been used as like navigators for health plans. Some progressive districts have hired community health workers as part of their community schools models. You see them in employment also, right? Helping connect people to training resources and stuff. So they really do play a fundamental function because the average community health worker or promotora lives in the neighborhood where they're working, is connected, knows the climate, the environment, knows where people go to cash checks, right? And can outreach and engage them in a way that an institution or a career professional might not be connected to reaching them.
And this is a lot centered around rural communities. These are medical deserts in some ways. Can you talk about the impact on this on rural communities?
Yeah, one of our projects was definitely in a rural setting, Orange Cove, Reedley, and Parlier. And these are places that are near and dear to my heart because I grew up there. I was the 1985 Miss Cinco de Mayo for Orange Cove, California.
It's one of my
claims to fame. Yes.
The real OC.
The real OC. You know, this, the days of Victor Lopez. What happens in rural areas is that people do not have the same engagement like they might have in more urban areas, right? Like you can take a bus to get to a grocery store, a park, or someplace you need to be for social service. While there could be potentially a dial-a-ride or some rural transit, coming from those areas means it's all day for just that one appointment, right? And there are things that are available to rural residents that they may not be aware of, telemedicine, right? They may not be in the know about, you can fill out your Medi-Cal application online. You can actually apply from other programs. And if you're not digitally literate, having someone like a promotora, a community health worker supporting you in that can make all the difference between you ripping your hair out because you're just going to give up and you can't work through this system. Having somebody to guide you is really beneficial, especially if you're somebody who's struggling post-COVID, that you may have lost your husband, or you may have lost your job and simply can't find another job, to feel like you're in a really desperate state and it's hard to see above the hole you're in. And having somebody come in and lend you a hand and pick you up and connect you, again, is going to give you peace of mind. It's going to help your mental health. It's going to lower your stress. And you're going to be connected to what you need, so then you can move past that. And so that's my real just disappointment with the loss of this, is that I know that there's going to be people who will continue to struggle to try to find help and won't be able to do it on their own because of language, because of technology, because of geography, right? All of those issues.
Why have our healthcare systems in Fresno County and beyond not picked up these roles and embedded them in their institutions?
It's a really good question. I think that most of the community health workers, promotoras that I know of historically, were volunteers, right? They were trained by maybe a nonprofit, and they were just people who really wanted to help their community and were doing things at no cost. And then some people started writing grants, right, and started training people. And you see a few junior colleges that actually have like community health worker training programs. But what the promotoras have never been able to do effectively is figure out how to get reimbursed through traditional systems like Medi-Cal or health plans. And it's because this is not a field that people consider a real profession and do not value it, right? So we get back down to, is a promotora who can connect with 50 people and do applications for them providing any less service than a healthcare provider who treats one person in an hour and charges $300, right? Like, I think there's just different levels of service, not to discount how important physicians are, but our promotoras are awesome and they can do really good work and really help to keep people healthy so that they don't end up with some chronic disease and in the emergency room needing the attention and use of medical equipment to diagnose somebody, right? I think it's just part of our values haven't aligned with what we really know to be important.
Let's talk about where this money comes from. What's being cut and by whom?
Yeah, last month is when I first got hip to this idea of freezes that the Trump administration said would be a way to prevent this government spending of needless dollars, right? Like their interest of really trying to rail in this loose government spending. And then I know there was like a federal judge who like stepped in and was like, hey, let's just be careful of this. These are really valuable services and we can't just do this willy-nilly. But we're at a point where CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, is being collapsed. These programs that were running through Health and Human Services or CDC are being looked at as unnecessary. When you look at a grant and health disparities, rural California, vulnerable immigrants and residents of this area, from a Trump lens, that's not what you want to see money go to, right? You're still under this false sense of belief that all immigrants are criminals and rapists and drug dealers, right? So you don't want to help them. So you're like, okay, let's just get rid of this. And so essentially that's what's happened. We receive this money through the health department. The health department receives this money through a federal grant, through Health and Human Services or CDC. Those monies, they're told you can no longer fund that. And so then it just cascades down, like you're collapsing everything where that was connected to these resources.
And this was tied to COVID money in a lot of ways, right?
Yes.
And so that's one of my questions I have is that money was going to go away at a certain point. And so how do we build that into a permanent funding structure so we're not just on a precipice whenever we get some administration or when the funding runs out?
Just we haven't really valued the role of community health workers. We also haven't really valued the work of prevention or public health. And I think people finally donned on them the importance of public health with COVID, right? Like how everything seems so connected, right? Like all of these things were essential. Our farm workers were essential. The nurse was essential. The public health worker was essential. The grocery store was essential, right? Like people, when prevention is effective, it means that your life isn't disrupted, that you can carry on your life without any interruption. When prevention isn't effective, that's when you see people's lives being interrupted because of premature death, because of accidents that shouldn't happen, because of food contamination, because of faulty maintenance of a facility, because of mold that your landlord refuses to take care of, right? These are all public health issues, and we have public health infrastructure that tries to address all of those things, right? From our environmental health inspectors to the public health nurse to the community health worker. And so all of these things are imperatively valuable, but if you dismiss their importance, then you're not funding them. You're not figuring out ways that you sustain this work. And so public health really operates, especially at the nonprofit level, through philanthropy, through government grants, through federal grants that allow us to do the work that we know to be important and that has value in our communities. And so as long as we're connected to these streams of funding that have horizons, we'll always be in a state of having to lose dollars and apply for more funding and on this never-ending roller coaster that I've been on for longer than I want to believe. But if we really felt as a society that all of these things were important, then we would find a way to ensconce them in some mechanisms like our healthcare plans that would continue to support this work beyond
Medicaid, which is something that's a permanent fixture of our system.
Right. And some of the nonprofits that were affected by this funding were receiving some reimbursements through Medicaid and through Medi-Cal. But you had told me in our interview for this story that was imperfect. Could you go into a little bit of why that's not a perfect fix for everyone?
I'll take ourselves, for instance. So I'm a single executive director. I now really wish there were a co-director in my world, but I'm a single assistant director and I have a staff, including myself, of 20. And they're community health workers, they're resource specialists, they're project managers, project coordinators, executive assistants, things like that. And so in order to really be effective at Medi-Cal billing, you have to have a whole infrastructure that's about the number of minutes spent with this patient at this rate. Multiply that by every community health worker you have that's doing that work. And so, for instance, in the current reimbursement systems that we had, a community health worker who was doing health education got a lower amount. A community health worker who was spending an hour, 2 hours doing a Medi-Cal enrollment got a higher amount. So that's the detail that you need to know within Medi-Cal billing. And then you have to be able to bill. You have to have a contract. You have to be approved as a Medi-Cal entity that can bill. And all of that takes time and effort and energy and infrastructure to be able to do. And so if you're a small nonprofit like ours, that's not at the forefront of what you're doing, because you're focused on trying to deliver the services with the staff that you have.
Yeah. So what percentage of your healthcare workers' staff time is around like all the paperwork and all the billing and all the charting and all the stuff? What does that look like?
In these two programs that are going to get cut, they were tied to a system called CCS, where they would have to report things like an enrollment, an assessment, notes on the referral, the opening and the closing of referrals. So you could have one individual that you were helping that might have had a variety of different services, from food, from housing, employment, education, right? And so you might have had different pathways open. All of that would have to be documented by the end of the month. So the way that the system worked was you would start it up whatever point in the month you were. At the end of the month, you would complete, close out whatever was done, and disenroll that person if it was truly complete, like everything had been satisfied, or move them on to the next month where more services would be. But every month you had to close out, and those things that were closed out were what you would get reimbursed for. So that was one project, the Hope PCH. The Health Disparities Project, we literally have to do an invoice. So my staff would have to account for their time. We would charge all of our operating expenses, office expenses, supplies for them to do their work. And then at the end of the month, I or a team member would do the invoicing and then submit that for reimbursement. We would have to pay for this up front and then get the reimbursement back for all of those monthly, previous month services. So it's a lot of work just to do that. And now we're thinking about another system that's just about tracking by the minute their work so that we could bill it to Medi-Cal. So there's a lot of capacity building for a small nonprofit to be able to really get into the Medi-Cal billing. Yeah.
It seems really tedious, but I just keep coming back to this. If it helps keep people out of the ER and out of emergency care, my family has been in the ER, no joke, 6 times in 2025. Our bills are ridiculous. And prevention, some preventative stuff probably could have kept us out of some of those visits. And so I just think like it's, why aren't the insurance companies demanding more of this? Because they're the ones that are going to have to pay for a lot of these bills.
Yeah. I think, again, that we have a model that's about sick care where we've monetized it, right? And people make income off of people being sick. We don't really have a model where people profit off of prevention and wellness. I think that there are things that are resources and paid programs. So like a gym membership, right? Like technically could be seen as wellness. And if you have the luxury of having discretionary dollars where you can pay for a gym membership, great. You get more exercise in your day. If you have more discretionary income, you can afford the organic food, right? You're going to go to Whole Foods. You're going to get the nice, healthy items. If you're feeding a family of five and you are a packing house worker and you're trying to stretch your dollars, you know, you're probably going to be buying more chips and sodas that are things that are cheaper that keep your family from feeling hunger, but aren't necessarily the diet that prevents you from developing chronic disease, right? And you add the stress, you add the violence that may be in your neighborhood, the dilapidated housing that you can afford, like all of these other factors compound and influence our health in very profound ways, right? Whether you can walk outside safely, or whether you prefer your kids to be indoors playing video games because the neighborhood outside is not where you want them to be, right? Like all of these things profoundly impact our health and well-being. And that's public health, right? That's community health programs that are trying to open up school gates so kids have a safe place to play. There are churches and nonprofits working together to improve the diets of the neighborhoods where they're operating by bringing in community gardens and all these other stuff, right? That's the role of public health and prevention in these nonprofits like Cultiva la Salud are trying to do. But compare this, like, it's like a tic-tac trying to feed a whale, because McDonald's will spend $1 million a minute to market their unhealthy food. I can get one grant for $1 million. That's a 3-year grant that I have to stretch, right? It's the what we have to fight against is so overwhelming, right? Like we can barely make a dent. And so we really do need decision makers that value health and wellness and understand the importance of prevention and drive dollars to the infrastructure and the food systems that disadvantaged community members need in order to lead healthier lives. Yeah,
can you talk about who's going to pick up the slack, if you will? So when services go away, someone has to, whether it's emergency rooms. I've watched in my career in public education, schools become social services, essentially. We have every kind of social service imaginable located on campus because they're not as accessible in other places. There's a Camarena Health right on the campus of the school that I work at.
Yeah. Schools will continue to pick up the slack, lack thereof. This is not a good story for schools because those families are now going to have less resources. But schools don't pick up the slack in every sense. So for example, you could have a family in crisis and those kids might have access to a social worker or a school psychologist. The parents don't, right? And so again, like this is the value of if there was a community health worker who understood the crisis that family was undergoing, could try to find the resources that help that family from just imploding. So who's going to pick up the slack? I would say that in our scenario, these community health workers that will likely be laid off are still connected to all of the community members that they were serving. And they're probably still going to get calls and they're going to have to say, oh, I no longer work there. But you should do this, right? Yeah. You should go here. You should talk to so-and-so to help you complete this. And so I do feel we revert back to those informal economies of people who know people will continue to refer people the best that they can. But I doubt that they'll be in positions where they can fill out the application or drive people or do the extra step that they were doing when they had the luxury of being paid to do that. So I think it'll dismantle. It won't be the same, but I know that there are really loving and caring people that I employ and that the other nonprofits employ that will still be the people receiving calls, right, from community. And I think, unfortunately, we're going to see all of the other systems impacted. We already have a dismal mental health care system. Nobody knows how to access it. Very few people avail themselves to any of it. Our healthcare system is, unfortunately, where people are going to end up back in ERs, right? Trying to figure out what's going on with them. People are going to become more depressed, and so it'll heighten the stress that's in our families, the domestic violence that could ensue, the substance abuse that will ensue, right? All of those things that we know is the antithesis of what we were trying to do with this program, those disparities will grow.
Yeah, and an inundated emergency room is not going to be able to give the best service because they're inundated. Right. And then you have private equity taking over emergency rooms and trying to turn people into...
Yeah. Another story about the lawsuit with the hospital.
But anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit trail. Yeah. But.
When you had told me something in our interview a few days ago about some of the hot topics that a lot of the promotoros that worked with you were hearing, could you just share some of the big issues that kept popping up?
Yeah. There's two major issues. There's a lot of issues, but there's two major issues. And one of them by far is housing, right? Like we struggle with a housing stock. Very few for the communities that we're serving are considered affordable, even when they're supposed to be affordable housing projects. There's a limit to the affordable housing projects that are developed in rural areas. Those affordable housing projects get taken up very quickly. And like what our community health workers would do is like literally just scan wherever there was some posting on a Facebook, on some church bulletin about somebody had a room for rent, apartment was coming up. They would help do applications for them. They would advise them. Family members who were living multiple families in a home, a garage conversion that somebody told them about, right? These were all things that our community health workers were tapping into and helping to identify for families, right? So that's hard to replace, like that underground sort of connection. The other major area that I've already mentioned is mental health, like mental health for non-English speakers, people living in poverty is inaccessible, right? It's hard to think about going to a mental health appointment through translation or interpretation, right? Like you're not going to get the same benefit that you need. And I think that's all a byproduct of other decisions that were made that really dismantled mental health, right? That are not resourcing the importance of people being healthy of their mind. And so nobody wants to go into that field, right? Like, we don't have troops of students saying, I want to be a social worker, a mental health care provider. And they know that there's just not good funding for it. It's not a position unless you become a psychiatrist or a psychologist and you move to the Bay Area where people have money to afford you and pay you, right? That's different. So I do think that there's a lot that we need to do to improve public health and mental health care in our communities. We've always shamefully been a region that, despite the fact that we grow all the fruits and vegetables that feed the rest of our state and the nation, are a huge area of food insecurity. So I would say that was another theme of just connecting people to food resources, whether it was the food bank or a local church that's distributing in Reedley, Parley, or Orange Cove, those type of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're seeing cuts to mental health programs in the VA. It's really across the board. Can you talk about the broad health impacts that these cuts will have on our communities? What are we going to see as a result of this?
Yeah. So if you don't have health insurance, you're likely not going to any health care provider, right? And this is something that's been very common. And while I was really grateful to be in space and places where in the last few years, we were signing things like a Medi-Cal expansion that was allowing undocumented seniors to get Medi-Cal for the first time, that we were ensuring that children were eligible and enrolling in all of these health plans. Again, the application process is not easy for somebody who's illiterate, who doesn't read, who doesn't have technology, right? Like, they're not going to have that hands-on support. What happens when people don't have health insurance is that they rely on traditional folk medicine, right? Those sobaderos that are out there that may help them feel a little bit better in the moment, but isn't necessarily curative. I grew up in a time where people boiled avocado seeds and drank the tea from that thinking that it was a curative for diabetes, right? There is a lot of things that people do with the well intentions, but do not have the benefit of real access to health care. My father was 53 years old when he died of heart disease. That was largely because he did not have access throughout his younger years to a physician that would have told him, hey, you have very high cholesterol and you have high blood pressure, and that's a deadly combination. You're probably going to die at 53 if you don't change your ways. So they're not going to get the health education that they need that supports them if they did have a disease that is diagnosed. My aunt was also fairly young when she passed away from diabetes. And what my aunt used to do, because she did not have access to healthcare regularly, is that she would try to dilute her insulin, thinking that it would make it last. Instead of taking like the full dose, she would take half a dose. And eventually she lost a toe, she lost a foot, she lost a leg, and she lost her life. Like, those are the type of stories we're going to hear more of, because people will have less access to the health education they need. They will have less access to the providers that they need to be seeing. They will have less access to the medications that they need to be taking. That's the reality of what's going to happen.
What cuts are on the horizon? What should we be watching for over the next couple weeks?
I feel like everything is doom and gloom, right? Before going to this last trip in North Carolina that I was sharing with you guys, I was in Washington, D.C. with Visión y Compromiso. And I would say that Visión y Compromiso is the premier, like, advocate historical group that's been fighting for promotoras, aka community health workers. And we did a series of legislative visits with promotoras that were brought to D.C., and we met representatives. I intentionally met with the representatives who represent me. And nobody had a good idea about what to do to stop what is coming. And what is coming is cuts in our SNAP Ed, which is our food stamps that most people would refer to them as. What is coming is cuts to Medi-Cal. So even if you have Medi-Cal right now, it doesn't mean that you will continue to have it. It doesn't mean that it'll cover the same things that it did cover. And so that is not good for our region. Again, we're one of the poorest congressional districts. We have a lot of needs in terms of health care, in terms of food access, in terms of housing, in terms of mental health. And these two programs are going to decrease, meaning that families will be hungry, people will get desperate, and we'll see likely results of that desperation that affect all of us who live here.
Can you tell a story or talk about a healthcare worker that's worked with you that's done some things for a local community?
There's a lot of these stories. And actually, I'm hoping that these community health workers of Cultivas will have an opportunity to voice that during public comment at the next Board of Supervisor meeting. But these are the type of stories that I would read, because we would ask our community health workers every month to write one success story. So these are just some that are stick out in my head. So there was a teen mom who had every interest of going on to higher education, but it became really difficult after she had her child, and she really didn't know how she was going to manage. And with the work of community health workers who helped her fill out her financial aid application, who helped her identify where she could get childcare, she was able to enroll, right? So she's thriving, and she's on a pathway to become a nursing student, nursing graduate, who will be able to come back and care for her community. And it's because a community health worker didn't let her give up.
What's it going to take? You were talking about promotoras and community health workers as part of this larger genre of care workers. And we see this with in-home supportive service workers. We see this with daycare workers, preschool teachers. There's a larger movement and conversation about what's it going to take for a society to value the contributions that they provide, and AI is not replacing them anytime soon. So how do you see that shift happening in our discussions?
I think it is a shift that requires a lot of consciousness building, because there is a segment of our community who doesn't need a community health worker, right? Like, they make sufficient amount of money where they can pay for their kids to be in sports and karate and ballet, and they can afford to go to the Whole Foods, and they can pay their mortgage payment without effect, right? There is a whole segment of our community that is privileged, and I'm grateful. Like, I hope that my children will be part of that segment of society, but I also hope that they realize that at some point, maybe it was a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or a sister or brother who made some wrong choices that now is in a much different position, who is worthy of help. And so I think it is us really living our values as a Christian society, that we do care for each other, and that we do care for each other, and that that is displayed publicly, right? That we believe that justice is these investments that help more of us be successful and be healthy and be happy, instead of now where it's pull yourself up by the bootstraps like I did, right? No, you didn't. You inherited this wealth and this property. But it is recognizing that, right? That some people, for whatever reason, have disadvantage, do not have all the privilege or all the benefit, and educating our kids, right? We haven't talked about the destruction of education that's also looming, but the education of our kids is about that, is about giving more people the opportunity to be productive in our communities, that access to healthcare is about preserving fathers so that they can stay home, and mothers, and work and support their children, right? And mental health is about us getting through these really crazy things that happen in life and helping people figure out how to manage that, how to grieve through that, and how to come out on the other side. And so all of this really does take a frame of, like, you believing that's the right thing to do.
So we close these podcasts every week with what we're loving. Who wants to go first today?
What I'm loving is I have a fantastic executive assistant who literally will come in and give me like the hype every morning that I love. Nobody asked her, but she's like, you're the woman. You created this organization. You're doing all these wonderful things. Like, hell yeah. And she'll clap it out. It's amazing. Nobody told her to do that. And she just has done that. And this little cheer session from my executive assistant is everything. It's wonderful.
Kind of like Obama's anger translator. Yeah. She's your hype translator.
She's my hype translator.
Yeah, I love that.
I really need that. Yeah. My husband is like the closest thing I have to that, but that's so amazing.
Yeah.
Donnie, what are you loving this week?
Okay, the strawberry stands are open, guys.
Oh, they are.
The strawberry stands.
Oh my God.
Open. Yeah, so I
go. You have a preferred one.
Of course.
What's your preferred?
Doesn't everyone in Fresno have a preferred strawberry stand?
When I moved here, I always got the map. I know where to go.
Yeah, so I go to one on Clinton, just west of Marks, west of the 99. And it's this wonderful family who owns it, and they have literally the best strawberries. They're organic, they're freshly picked. It's the whole family that owns the business. And then they also have some vegetables as well.
What do you do with the strawberries? Just Go right in? Or what
they're too delicious to save for anything. That's the problem, honestly. Yeah.
But so you just eat them by themselves?
Yeah. So I bought a whole flat for, what, $23 on Thursday, and my kids have annihilated it. But I'll buy...
Just red teeth running around the house?
Yes. And I'll try to save it. No, let me make strawberry pizza, or let me make some jam, and they just devour it. But then I'll buy the, like, Driscoll's, whatever, at the store, and they won't eat any of them. So there's a huge quality difference.
I love to make some homemade whipped cream with them.
Just
slice them up,
so
just throw them in a big bath of whipped cream.
Agree. So good.
I like the really small ones. It's just so different because I have friends that don't live near fresh strawberries. And
what a horrible existence.
I know, and they're just so water-filled. Mm-hmm. They've been shipped halfway across the world. And just that really delicate sweetness is incredible.
Yeah.
I'm loving two things this week, two ends of the spectrum. One, this last week, I attended the Fresno Philharmonic's annual fundraiser called Farm to Fiddle, which was so much fun. It's like music in a barn. You eat a dinner. There's an auction. And it was just, the music was incredible. The food was great. It was so much fun. And then on that same kind of note, in a different direction, I'm also loving White Lotus like many people right now.
I just started season one yesterday.
Started season one yesterday?
Yes, me too. Good day before yesterday.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to text you.
You guys have so much work to do.
There's been so much hype about season three, and I've been wanting to start it. But my kids go to bed ridiculously late. So.
Yeah, Sydney Sweeney in season one is incredible. There's so much incredible
stuff. I didn't know that level of mean girl was possible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
She's insane. Her mean girl levels are
off the chart. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's an incredible show, and we're recording this, and then this following Sunday is going to be the season finale. Season three is a little different than the past two. So it's set in Thailand, and it's a really Buddhist season. It's all about Buddhism and identity and people coming to terms with figuring out who they are and who they're not. And some people have criticized this season because they said it doesn't have quite the plot development that the prior two had, but I'm absorbed. And
how is Parker Posey? Because that's really what I'm trying to get to.
Oh, my God. I love me a highly medicated, wealthy white woman from the South. Oh my God, it's so good. Every time she opens her mouth, I'm just like enraptured. I can't get enough. We had Jennifer Coolidge on the first two seasons, but she's not in the third, and for reasons that I won't explain. And yeah, she's a worthy successor to Coolidge.
Love
her. Absolutely.
Love Parker.
So that's what we're loving this week. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.